Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Due to counsel cooperativeness or something in the water, we're down to only one case this morning on our oral submission docket, and that is Harry J. Joe and Gilchrist versus 239 Joint Venture from Dallas County and the Fifth Appellate Judicial District. We have allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. Justice Owen is not here today, and I suppose it's anybody's guess whether she will participate in the deliberation and decision of this case, but she is not disqualified from doing that. And we're pleased to welcome students from the 8th grade at Fairway Middle School in Killeen. We're making an oral tape of this argument, and you can purchase a copy of that from our clerk for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners.
May it please the court. Mr. Michael P. Lynn and Ms. Amy Ward will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Lynn will open with the first 12 minutes, and Mr. Prater Monning will present the rebuttal.
Good morning. I will speak on behalf of Mr. Joe and Mr. Jenkins. Ms. Warr will speak on behalf of the state of Texas with respect to the policy implications of the court's decision, and Mr. Prater Monning will close, speaking both on behalf of Mr. Joe and Mr. Jenkins. 2 years ago, this court in Perry decided that Texas and federal courts have recognized that individuals acting in their legislative capacity are immune from liability. The court then concluded, we do so not to protect the individual legislator, and I might add the lawyer or the law firm, but to serve the public interest. The Dallas court's decision disserves the public interest. If permitted to stand, the public business, the legislative process, will be inhibited and could be corrupted, as it was when 239 JV attempted to do so when it brought this case.
Can you point to me where the legislative immunity or absolute immunity argument was preserved? It's my understanding it was not raised in the trial court.
Well, with respect to Jenkins and Gilchrist, certainly both absolute immunity was asserted. With respect to Mr. Joe, in his summary judgment papers, he asserted immunity without designating whether it was official immunity or legislative immunity.
But wasn't it always couched in terms of good faith and not really didn't track the legislative or absolute immunity element?
Mr. Joe's pleadings did both. There was an affidavit that suggested that he was a legislator. He pled immunity. Summary judgment was granted with respect to the issue of immunity. There was no basis stated, so as I understand it, any basis that would support that summary judgment has to be evaluated by the courts, and I think that's where the Dallas Court of Appeals made its error. With respect to Jenkins and Gilchrist, it is absolutely clear that both were asserted, both official immunity and legislative immunity were asserted, because by that time we had seen briefing by the other side that had suggested that they were, I guess, confused in some way or feigning confusion.
Why couldn't Jenkins Gilchrist treat this like a conflict with another client and just present it to the two of them, let them choose whether they wanted to continue representation, and let firm choose whether, and Mr. Joe choose whether they wanted to continue their association?
Well, the discussion here is really legislative immunity, as I understand it. But your question raises really a very salient point. At the September meeting, when the notice, the Open Records and Meetings Act was invoked, and the 3 days' notice was given, Mr. Joe had no earthly idea who 239 JV was, and there's nothing in the record to suggest he did. what the duty is, the reason the duty is so unworkable and so broad, it would require Mr. Joe, who doesn't have a clue as to whether or not 239 JV exists or what its interests are, to go back, search through, I don't know.
But they did firms do that all the time. I mean, suppose the group that was opposing this development and arguing for a moratorium had come to him that weekend and said, we want you to represent us. Of course, he couldn't do that, but a lawyer at the firm said, we want you to represent us in this matter. You just have to do a conflict check.
Your Honor, had that occurred, he would have been on notice and been able to decline it and search it. But where you're asking a legislator, such as Mr. Joe or any legislator in the state of Texas, to go to their firms, look through the 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 matters that might be open at any given point or in the past, and divine what their interests might be, and within 3 days then seek their consent as to whether or not the vote, well, determine whether the vote would be adverse or in their favor, and then seek their consent, it's unworkable. And that's why I believe this court in Perry made the decision that where the acts are related to legislation, there is a grant of immunity.
No. So if Mr. Tao, that's his name, had been the city council person, no difference in the result?
The only difference that I could see, there would be no difference if the immunity were granted. If this court finds that legislative immunity means what I believe it says, what this court stated in Perry, you're absolutely correct.
So he's got a fiduciary duty to this client. He's taken on, he knows what their interest is. They want him to go out there and do everything they can do to get this development done. And yet he's going to walk out of the building, go down the street, and vote against it.
I believe that the appropriate solution to that would be political. I believe that we are in a, this court is setting policy with respect to whether the legislators are going to be saddled with civil liability, whether they're going to establish a duty that would require each legislator to search every client to determine whether or not there was an adverse interest.
Well, I know both sides have argued that there's no solution to this except a very difficult position, but it seems to me that it's awfully hard to tell a client, you know, your lawyer, if you're looking to represent your best interest, is going to be casting the deciding vote this afternoon at the city council against your interest. I mean, it looks like a client would be legitimately frustrated by that.
Well, I can understand full well the frustration of a client, but there, I think, is a larger public need here, and that's to preserve the legislative process from becoming corrupted or pressure being placed unduly on legislators. Because I submit that if this court were to establish such a duty, the legislative process, if it had lawyers, would grind to a halt. There is certainly no way that anyone can possibly go through the legislature and look at the 5,000 or so bills that are submitted, as well as the amendments, and make a determination within the number of days that are required as to what the interests are of every client within the firm. Now, does that client have an obligation or have an opportunity to move on to another law firm? Can they become upset? Yes. There are lots of lawyers in Texas, and I am sure they can find representation somewhere
else. But if they become upset, that's after the fact. The vote's already taken place. They didn't know about it because they weren't advised. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
In Justice Heck's hypothetical, if Mr. Tao, knowing what he knew about both what was happening on the public side and privately in dealing with the 239 joint venture, was going to go ahead and attend the first vote on the moratorium and vote in favor of it, would he have had a duty to disclose that to 239 joint venture since he was on notice and would have known about both sides of this equation?
Your Honor, as I understand it, the duty would be absolute, except for a few, very rare exceptions, invidious legislative intent, I think, was one of them that was outlined in Perry. Not unlike diplomatic immunity, that might exist with respect to those who are involved in an embassy. In this situation, I guess since the beginning of organized democracy, including, I might add, Rome, the Senate was always exempt from any liability, both criminal or civil.
Let me ask, but you suggested, if I can just follow up, you suggested that there was something material about an absence of being put on notice of this vote coming up earlier. I'm asking now if it were Mr. Tao, who was going to the council meeting, who had been representing 239 was on notice, in fact, had actual knowledge of all the representation provided by the firm and him of 239 joint venture, would he have had a duty to at least disclose to 239 joint venture that he was going to vote on that moratorium and that the issue was coming up at the next council meeting, even if it was only with 3 days' notice?
Not if the Perry decision is to hold. Because drawing the distinctions, I believe, are going to result in an unworkable solution. I understand Your Honor's question as to whether when he was on notice. The answer is I don't think he should have done so. The question for the court is whether or not we are going to create civil liability as a result of him doing so.
Does it make any difference? The question was framed in terms of duty, and I guess that's where one of my questions goes. What is the duty that is claimed, and does it make a difference in the legislative immunity sphere? And forget about Mr. Joe being on the city council. Just assume that Mr. Joe, as a result of whatever work he was doing, gains information that the city council is planning to put a moratorium on apartment building in its community and lets one of his clients know so that that client can get a permit in and attempt to get grandfathered before the moratorium, and another client, of whom he's unaware but is a client of the firm, does not get that information. Would there have been a duty on the part of the firm to have notified all their apartment building clients within that community of that pertinent information? Would there have been a duty to have conveyed that, even if Mr. Joe had no idea that their firm had another client out there? Would there still have been a duty to convey the information? See what I'm saying?
I believe so. Let me answer it two ways. It is clear to me that if a lawyer comes in and engages a person, a firm, to represent them before the city council, under those circumstances, I believe there would be a duty.
Forget about city council. I'm just saying Mr. Joe represents an apartment builder who's in that community, and as a result of that gains information that the community is thinking about putting a moratorium, and so he gives the information to his client so his client can get the grandfathered in. After that happens and the moratorium passes, lo and behold, it turns out that Mr. Joe's firm, also a different lawyer, represents another apartment builder there who didn't get that information.
I understand.
Was there a duty there for the firm to have conveyed that information to that other apartment builder?
It depends on the engagement. If somebody engages you, for example, on a wills and estate issue, and a matter comes in reflecting some sort of change in the antitrust laws, you may, as a matter of course, because of your knowledge of the client, give them a call and suggest that they need to pay attention to the antitrust decision. But I don't think you're obligated to under our present rules, because the scope of the engagement was limited.
Would the legislative immunity, let's assume that there was a duty for the firm gains information that could benefit a client or not benefit a client. So assume that there's some sort of duty that information needs to be conveyed to the firm's clients, and they fail to do so. The mere fact that one of the lawyers within the firm is on the city council that ultimately will decide that moratorium, is there legislative immunity for a violation of that duty? The duty to convey information to the client, does that get covered up by legislative immunity just because one of the partners in the firm happens to be on the city council that's going to vote for that moratorium?
I believe the legislative immunity covers those persons who serve as legislators. I believe that the allegations here, and I'm not sure I'm answering the court's question, are derivative. That is, in this circumstance, there is no liability by Jenkins and Gilchrist as a result of anything that it did or did not do other than through the actions of Mr. Joe. So in that circumstance, I don't believe that Jenkins and Gilchrist can be held responsible.
The part I don't understand is if your argument about legislative immunity being absolute is correct, then why do you take the position that if Joe had been retained to represent the people before the council himself, that would be different? Looks like absolute is absolute.
I believe that absolute is absolute.
If he had taken the money to represent them before the council, because it still got in there and voted against it.
I believe that he could. However, should he have done that? Was that the politically right decision? Could he have been voted out of office as a result of the breach of that confidence? The answer is yes. The political system permits correction for that. The ALI, in the restatement, suggests that there should be that the lawyer serving as a city council person should not have accepted the representation. The ALI would balance this by saying that to the extent that offer is made, that representation is offered, then you should look to public law to determine whether or not you ought to abstain. And that leads, of course, I think, to 171 in the local government code.
Which says he should.
Which I believe says he should.
But doesn't that recognize that there's a conflict here? And the only reason to have that statute is because the legislature's made a decision. It's not right for a person with that direct personal interest to be voting for that interest in the public body.
Chapter 171 was in existence long before Chapter 171 was numbered 171. There was a time when municipal legislators were not covered back in the 50s, and I apologize, I don't remember the precise case that changed that. But until that point, state, local government had to be protected. My suspicion, and I can confirm this later, that statute was passed in order to give the same set, or almost the same sort of set of immunity that would have governed state legislators and other legislators, both in the federal and state system. I believe that Perry...
Looks like it would be passed to keep them from voting on stuff that were going to be compromised on.
If that is the case, that's the legislature's duty, and the ALI recognizes that it's a public law issue, that the legislators can pass laws, ordinances that say when one can vote and when one can't. But that would be political.
But the odd thing in this case is Mr. Joe could not vote for 239 joint venture, but he could vote against it.
Well, there is...
For the waiver, for example.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that. The ALI, for example, in the restatement, says that giving special preference to one side or the other would be inappropriate. And if I see that my time has expired, I would like to close with...
I think your time has expired. If you have a further answer to Justice Hicks' question, you may do that.
Which is, how come he can vote against his client but not for?
I believe that he can vote for his client. Restatement ALI would say that he could.
What you said, the statute said he couldn't.
No. Chapter 171, if he had an interest in it that was 10%, a substantial matter, then, of course, he couldn't. In this circumstance, I think that the briefs have argued that, and I guess our position, if I misspoke, was that he did not fall within 171.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
If I could close just one last sentence. In Bogan versus Janet, 1997, our position is summed up this way. Regardless of the level of government, the exercise of legislative discretion should not be inhibited by judicial interference or distorted by the fear of personal liability, a fear this court can eliminate by reversing and rendering the Dallas Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
May it please the court.
Ms. Ward, Mr. Lynn, I think, indicated that if Mr. Joe were representing 239 Joint Venture and zoning matters and appeared in front of the city council meeting, at the city council meeting, and voted against them on that very issue, that is, in favor of the moratorium, that there would still be immunity, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Isn't that different from the position of Senators Brown, Kane, Duncan, Ellis, and other representatives who filed an amicus brief? They cite a Virginia legal ethics opinion that talks about representing clients on the specific matter that's before the specific governing body. Didn't Mr. Lynn seem to take a different position from local senators?
That's possible, Your Honor. But legislative immunity, as has been discussed previously, is absolute. And even though, you know, there might be situations where it certainly wouldn't be advisable for a legislator to do what you just recounted, they are absolutely entitled to immunity from civil suit in that instance.
So the state agrees with Mr. Land and disagrees with the senators I mentioned?
The state disagrees with that particular position, as you have articulated it. Yes, Your Honor. This court is not being called upon today to decide the merits of the doctrine of legislative immunity. The court has already embraced that doctrine and the policy choices that it makes and the fact that certain bad actors might escape civil liability and clients may not have redress in some.
Well, I don't know that we ever put it in quite those terms. We're embracing this doctrine no matter who gets screwed. I just don't remember writing it like that. But it just seems to me odd that a legislator can go and take somebody's money and say, I'm going to do my best for you, and then not. And if he's a legislator, that's okay.
Your Honor, legislative immunity basically allows for that to occur in some circumstances, but the greater good of having independent and effective legislators for the public outweighs that. And obviously the doctrine of legislative immunity is not to protect individual legislators, but to protect the public.
Wouldn't we be better off with an independent legislator that wasn't cheating his clients? Seemed like that would be the best one.
Yes, Your Honor. And, you know, I think it's important to note that there is no crisis sweeping the state of attorneys acting against private clients' interests. And while, you know, some isolated cases could occur, civil liability simply shouldn't lie. And
generally, when they get criticized, it's for acting for their clients.
Exactly, Your Honor.
But the state takes up with it. The state doesn't think that's a good idea.
It doesn't think that...
It's a good idea for legislators to act for their specific clients.
No, absolutely not. And that
because there's a conflict.
I'm sorry?
There's a conflict there.
Yes, the duties that the Court of Appeals has imposed absolutely conflict with a legislator's duties to the public. And the people of Texas deserve legislators that are focusing only on the public interest and not looking over their shoulders constantly to see who might sue them. And that is exactly the result that legislative immunity is intended to protect against.
That is a very important obligation, obviously, of our elected officials and legislators. What about, Ms. War, as an attorney, the obligation, fiduciary obligation to clients? Isn't that also a very important obligation?
It is very important, Your Honor.
Are you saying we should ignore one and promote the other, or is there a way to promote both?
No, Your Honor. Obviously, we're saying here that there should be no civil liability, that people should not be able to sue their lawyers for damages if their lawyers happen to be legislators acting in their legislative capacity.
Now, let me... my view of a legislative immunity has always been in the context of trying to get around why the legislature voted the way they did, or why the legislator voted the way they did, or you voted to stop my building and didn't exercise the rules correctly, you didn't exercise the procedure correctly, you didn't give me notice. It always dealt with some official capacity in which they were operating. I'm not sure what that means when I have a private duty to a client that I breach and it results from some activity I perform as a legislator. Let me try and articulate it a little better. As a legislator, I learn that my body is going to be asked to vote on a moratorium on development over which I have governing authority. I have a private duty to a developer who's developing in that community, and my private duty is to let them know that there may be an issue coming before the legislative body that could affect their development. How does it interfere in the legislative process to recognize the private duties breach might result in damages, meaning I failed to let them know, as a result they couldn't grandfather in like everybody else who knew could grandfather in, and the duty that's breached is not the fact that I voted on the moratorium. The result of that moratorium is immaterial. The duty of the breach is that I had information that my failure to convey to my client harmed my client. And that's the duty that gets breached. And that's a duty that could be measured in terms of damages. How does that hurt the state policy of keeping legislators immune from being sued for damages that result as a result of their vote?
Your Honor, that's because in reality, the duties that 239 Joint Venture very artfully pleaded to try to circumvent legislative immunity, those duties that you just recounted, the duty to inform, for example, is merely the flip side of Councilman Joe's decision that the moratorium was in the best interest of the citizens of Irving, a legislative decision. All the duties that the Court of Appeals that they pleaded and that the Court of Appeals upheld were kind of the negative of those. To have complied with those duties would have meant to disavow Councilman Joe's decision.
It wouldn't be to give up the client. Why can't you just give up the client?
If he had known about the client, he could have done that. But the remedy for that...
But you wouldn't require him to do that.
No, Your Honor. But the remedy for that cannot be, even if there was a breach of a duty, the remedy for that cannot be a suit in damages.
So, Ms. Ward, assuming, as I think parties have argued, that Mr. Joe didn't know about the representation of 239 Joint Venture before the September vote, and there's a meeting that he had, I think Mr. Toe set it up, as I recall the briefing, with representatives of 239 Joint Venture in November 1994, then there's another vote in December, following up on Justice Heck's question, so that even with actual knowledge, it wouldn't have been an obligation to disclose to the client what he was planning to vote, how he was planning to vote, or to give up the client before the December meeting, even with actual undisputed knowledge of the conflict.
Well, at that point, of course, the client also knew Mr. Joe's position and knew how it was going to, everything was going to come out. And the client still, you know, kept Jenkins and Gilchrist. To me, the question could be also the client could have fired Jenkins and Gilchrist. But instead, the client chose to continue with that representation with the hopes of influencing Councilman Joe.
That may be so. My question is, what was Mr. Joe's obligation?
He had no obligation to inform the client. Absolutely not.
Or give up the client?
No, he had no obligation to do so. He, of course, could have done so. The firm could have done so. But there is no obligation to do so that is redressable via a suit for damages.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. David L. Patterson will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David Patterson. I'm with the law firm of Godwin Gruber, LLP, out of Dallas, representing the respondent, 239 Joint Venture, who are made up of the principals Richard Strauss, Arthur Hewitt, and Francesco Gillespie and their related entities. Before I came here today, I looked at the Texas Lawyers Creed that was issued by this court in 1989, and I noted that the very first stated obligation of the lawyer is one of allegiance. And the result sought by the petitioners would appear to eliminate that duty for the lawyer public official, the private lawyer public official. And
so he's just supposed to vote however his clients tell him, but the statute says he can't.
No, I do not agree that he is to vote how the clients tell him.
What does allegiance mean if you're not going to take the position your client wants you to?
I think the lawyer has an obligation to the reasonable lawyer, and I'm talking about someone in Mr. Joe's position with a large law firm like Jenkins and Gilchrist in Dallas with a significant real estate practice about to vote on an issue that has a direct impact on real estate developers, an impact that is different from the impact that it would have on the general public.
So if it was just higher taxes, that would be different.
And that is one of the points I wanted to make today, Justice Hecht, and that was that I believe this case in some ways is limited to its facts. And in part, it's limited to its facts because in this situation, apart from the general public, this real estate developer, our client, did have a method and an opportunity to avoid the effect of the moratorium. The general public, when you're passing a tax increase or some other general legislation that applies to the general public, the general public has no method to avoid the effect of the legislation. So this is a more limited situation where
they can go get a legislator to vote against it. That's their campaign.
Well, I think that's
citizens against higher taxes, and they go hire Jenkins and Gilchrist, and they say, get down there and try to stop this.
Well, that's what lobbyists do, Your Honor. But in this situation, and it's unique, is that we do believe that the lawyer, private lawyer, public official, lawyers don't have special access rights to legislative office. Except for certain judicial positions, it doesn't require a law license.
Which is not legislative.
And in our position is, if a private attorney chooses to run for public office, it does not mean that therefore he gives up his obligations to his private clients.
That's going to make it pretty hard for a lawyer at a big firm to take on that kind of public service, because you're going to have potentially thousands of clients to do a conflicts check on every time a vote comes up.
It does, Your Honor, but I don't believe that that's any different from when a lawyer brings in a new client to
a
firm.
But it's not even limited to every time a vote comes up, but any bill that is before the legislature. We're sort of in a unique situation here. We can kind of compare what's going on in this court and then go across the street in the Capitol. There are all kinds of bills being filed. There are a lot of lawyers in the Capitol representing clients. Just in practical terms, if you represented a senator who was a private lawyer but also has an obligation to the public as a senator, what would you advise him or her to do if we were to adopt the rule that you propose?
Well, Your Honor, I do know that from the last election cycle, and there were numerous articles, I know the petitioners cited some articles from the Texas lawyer about this case. There were numerous articles about conflicts that, for instance, Mayor Ron Kirk of Dallas was being paid by his law firm at the same time he was mayor. And one of the articles that I saw in the paper was that they had procedures in place to protect against Mayor Kirk running afoul of the interests of the firm's clients. And in this situation, neither the law firm nor Mr. Joe had any procedures in place. Apparently, their position
Let's look at in broader terms. There are House bills out there right now that, if I were back in private practice, I would be sending, and not in the legislature, I'd be sending all kinds of letters saying, here is a piece of legislation that could impact you adversely, you might want to consider hiring a lobbyist. You might want to consider doing that. There are all kinds of, there's legislation that's very important, has statewide impact to both public and private concern. And my question to you is how, if you're a senator in a large firm, how are you supposed to advise your client on each and every one of those? And to what extent can, under the rule that you propose, a legislator really serve in both capacities?
I believe that, and particularly as is shown by the record in this case, Jenkins and Gilchrist has an email system, firm-wide email system, firm-wide voicemail system, and every firm, even our firm, through our computer systems, have conflict systems set up to check for conflicts. I'm not suggesting that and particularly in this case, although it's our position that he may have had a conflict because there is an Attorney General, opinion DM 309, which analyzes the local government code, section 171, and states that the interest in the entity does not have to be a direct interest to create the conflict. And in our opinion, let's say you represent dry cleaners, and there's going to be legislation passed that will restrict how dry cleaners do business. At what point did you, if 50% of your clients are dry cleaners and it's going to affect them, can you vote on that issue? And so we believe there's a conflict that needs to be recognized, needs to be dealt with. But even if he's immune from the vote and he can go ahead and vote, the duty that we're complaining about in this case is the failure to even inform the client in the first instance that something is going to happen that can negatively impact them.
Let me be sure I understand. So you are not complaining about how he voted?
No. The complaint, I'm sorry.
You concede that even though 239 Joint Venture was a client of the firm, that does not require him to either vote against the moratorium or to abstain, as far as they're concerned.
Even if you accept their theory.
I'm asking about that. We're trying to get the parameters here of what this means. And in your view, did the client have the right, as a client, to have this lawyer either abstain or vote no?
Our position through our expert was that he did have a conflict situation because under our expert's analysis, using Attorney General Opinion DM 309, was that the lawyer got 100% of his salary from Jenkins and Gilchrist. Indirectly, his vote affected a client of the firm from whom they were taking fees. So, according to the Attorney General opinion, an indirect effect, because the statute doesn't distinguish between direct or indirect effect. It just says that it affects the client.
The statute says he can't vote yes.
Right.
Now, what about no?
And we believe the corollary is true, that he can't vote no either. But even if there is that conflict, we believe that that's irrelevant to our theory of liability, because our theory of liability, and admittedly, the moratorium passed unanimously. With Mr. Joe abstaining, it would have passed anyway.
Well, that's a question I have. How do you get over the proximate cause piece of that?
Yeah.
That even if you, I mean, let's just say, presuming without deciding, there were a duty and a conflict and a breach of that duty, how do you get past proximate cause? And two, my understanding is that the property was zoned as an apartment complex later, and the client received, some $100,000 more than they would have under this contract. How do you establish proximate cause and damages?
Well, the issue of proximate cause and damages, if you'll note from the Court of Appeals opinion, the issue of foreseeability was not raised in the summary judgment papers, and that's why the Court of Appeals states in the opinion that foreseeability is not an issue. What the evidence shows is that the client, one, incurred direct carrying costs on the property as a result of the moratorium.
Well, if you'll answer the proximate cause question first.
Yes. I apologize, Your Honor.
If everyone else would have voted anyway for the moratorium,
right,
then how do you get to causation?
And that's why I say that this case is unique and may be a standalone case, and that is because at the time, with the government code in effect, there was a grandfathering statute that allowed property owners who had platted their property apartment, not zoned. Did not have any effect. The property was already zoned apartment, and according to the testimony that I believe is in the record, that was its best use, was as apartment land. And it was already zoned apartment, and they were attempting to sell it to the buyer as apartment land. And the purchase price...
Let me focus the question on this. As I understand your complaint, it is not that he voted on the moratorium. Your complaint is that he failed to notify his client that a moratorium was going to get voted on so that his client could grandfather himself in and avoid the moratorium. Your complaint is not how he voted. Your complaint is not even that he voted. Your complaint is that he had information in advance of the vote that he failed to convey to his client. Not his true client, but within his firm, he failed to convey the information to the client.
Correct. That is our position.
But I thought there was a corollary to that, that if you did not win on that, then if he didn't have a duty to disclose it and get them grandfathered in, then he had a duty to abstain. So are you now saying if we decide there's no duty on the first instance, we don't need to address the other because there is no causation?
Well, I don't believe there is. Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And that's why I think this case is unique. And there was testimony in the record from our expert who has done municipal law and, in fact, had just in the year or two prior to giving his deposition, had platted some property for a car dealer in the city of Irving and knew that what it takes to file a plat is not a terribly complicated, involved process.
Doesn't that conflict with the legislator's duty to the public? If he's just, okay, let me grandfather all my firm clients so we can get several apartment complexes up before, doesn't that directly conflict with his duty to the public as a legislator?
Exactly. And that's the conflict he failed to recognize and deal with, is that he did have a conflict.
But
because
any lawyer legislator, most bills take effect September 1. So lawyer legislators should be scanning through the bills, several thousand pending bills, and scanning through their clients and advising people actions they should take between now and September 1, regardless of whether they vote or not for these bills.
That is probably the ultimate result, is that you will have to set up some system to be aware of the effects of your votes and what you do. But why I say this case is unusual, Judge, again, I keep going back to it.
Or not, I'm getting more and more confused.
Well,
let me ask this first. Do you disagree with anything in the Court of Appeals opinion?
No.
You'd be happy with a writ refused?
Yes.
So the primary duty, as you see it, I mean, what you're asking here is a duty to inform.
Correct, Your Honor.
You really don't care about whether he voted or how he voted.
I really don't, Your Honor.
Let me make sure I understand. The problem I have with that is it's a duty to inform as to something that is public record.
Yes.
So what would be wrong with, since the client did not hire the firm for the purpose of tracking this legislation, what would be the problem with saying the 239 decided to do that itself, that it was then charged with notice of anything that was public and it should have caught it and could have caught it first?
Justice O'Neill, there is a quote from the Restatement of Lawyers. It's at Section 20, Comment C, and it says, even if a client fails to request information, a lawyer may be obligated to be forthcoming because the client may be unaware of the client's knowledge, meaning the lawyer.
Is that dealing with public information, though? I mean, that's the wrinkle here. I think most of those don't deal with information that is available to the public.
And in addition, Mr. Patterson, your expert posits that Mr. Joe didn't know what was going to be on the agenda until the night before the council meeting. Understanding your brief, you go back to deposition testimony and quibble with that, but your expert posits that in his opinion. So Mr. Joe, at least according to your expert, didn't even know that was going to be on the agenda, or may not have known it was going to be on the agenda till the night before the actual vote. So in this case, 239 Joint Venture could have had access through a public document to knowledge that this was going to be on the agenda before Mr. Joe knew about it.
Justice Wainwright, if I may, I think, and maybe this addresses Justice O'Neill's question as well.
My question is...
And that is, the public would be charged with constructive notice. Here, we believe the law firm had actual notice. Now, and I'd have to go back and look at the opinion of our expert again.
Okay, so 239 is charged with constructive notice. Follow me through that.
Well, the posting of the notice is to provide people with the general public of
but
notice.
If they're charged with constructive notice, how can there be a duty to inform them of something they have constructive
well,
notice?
Well, we believe that the duty is because it's the difference between constructive and actual. And the statement and the statement from the restatement of the law governing lawyers that I just quoted, that the attorney can't assume that the client is aware of something negative that may happen to the client, particularly if it's material to the representation. That's Mr. Ta, if he had been, and testified in his deposition, if he had been aware of the moratorium that the vote was about to come up, he would have certainly informed the client and made sure they were aware of the law that was in effect at that time. He would have also had an obligation to inform the client, as their lawyer, that there was a method to avoid the effect of the moratorium by platting their property. So the information was not confidential. It was not something that Mr. Joe was prevented from disclosing to other members of the firm.
But you would require him to do something that would probably get him run out of office. I mean, if he did a moratorium for all of his clients and grandfathered them in, that he would be doing something that would be scandalous. So you're saying he can't even just step down and say, I'm not going to pass this on, I'm not going to sit on the vote, I'm not going to advise my clients, I'm just going to be totally neutral. You would say that would be a violation. He has a duty to grandfather in his people, which then is going to get him run out of office.
Yes, and that creates a conflict situation for the private attorney public official. It is certainly not our position that the legislative immunity or the local government code completely preempts and eliminates any duties that the private lawyer owes, the private lawyer public official owes to his clients.
But you have to acknowledge that if we took that sort of view, very few lawyers could serve on anything.
Without attempting to comply with their conflict situations, and it may require them to withdraw from representation of the client, and that's one thing that did not happen here. The issue needs to be spotted before the conflict gets to a problem, and the problem is when he does something that negatively impacts the client. That should have been spotted. There were no procedures in place to spot these issues. Those issues should have been spotted ahead of time.
Mr. Patterson, let's go back to causation. As you know, your client has to establish both prongs of proximate cause. You mentioned that foreseeability was not raised in the courts below. I don't know, but that's your argument. There's still but for causation, and you haven't answered the question about whether with an 8-1, then an 8-0, then an 8-1 vote, whether Mr. Joe's vote made a difference. You still have to prove but for causation here. Address that issue, if you would, please, directly.
Yes, and Justice Wainwright, the answer to that, again, is the complaint is not about the vote. We agree that the vote would have gone forward with or without Mr. Joe and likely would have passed.
Your complaint is a failure to disclose.
The complaint is, which we believe in the record, The issue.
Let me ask this question. If your complaint is a failure to disclose, how do you get the damages without looking at how the moratorium vote came out? If it had come out for your client, you wouldn't have a complaint here. It came out against your client. So the vote on the moratorium is pertinent to your case. How do you get from failure to disclose to damages without going through the causation, perhaps embodied in part, at least, in the votes?
The vote becomes irrelevant if you plat your property before the vote.
And let's assume, as your expert did, that Mr. Joe knew about what was going to be on the agenda the night before. So let's assume that away without deciding. Okay, let's just go from failure to disclose the votes to damages. But for causation with an 8-1, 8-0, and 8-0 votes on the three, on the moratorium and the two extensions. The argument is Mr. Joe, the argument being made is that Mr. Joe's vote didn't make a difference, so you can't prove causation. And I need you to address that directly, given how strong the vote was in favor of the moratorium.
Our position is the client had a method to avoid the effect of the vote. Maybe I'm not understanding your question.
There was no method to avoid the effect
yes.
of the vote. In address causation.
That is why I think, yes, I apologize, Your Honor. That's why I think this case is unique, is because this client did have a method to avoid the effect of the vote.
It's really not.
And that's why, I'm sorry, excuse me, Judge.
I gather this duty's the same. It doesn't matter that he didn't find out about it until the night before the vote. You'd think he had a duty as soon as it was introduced to be scanning this for his clients, for his duty under the law governing lawyers that you would have us adopt.
First of all, Your Honor, let me answer your question this way. I believe the record shows that there's a fact issue on that, because the testimony that our expert...
I'm interested in duty. Does the lawyer legislator have a duty to be vigilant about the docket pending before the body that he serves in?
I would believe he would.
So our lawyer legislators over in the Texas legislature need to be cognizant of all these bills. And their duty is not excused. In fact, it might be worse if there's a bill plodding through committee that would adversely affect their client and they're not focusing on it because they're busy with the budget or something important like how the courts are structured.
Well, I think there would be some obligation on the part of the attorney, the private attorney, public official, to focus on whether matters are going to come up that will affect the clients. Generally, I think there will be the client will have no recourse because there's no way for the client generally to avoid the effect of a general public law.
Well, but if somebody puts a bill in the hopper to state what the statute of limitations is on fraud, cases are in conflict, we don't know, is it 2 years or 4 years? Somebody puts in a bill, says it's going to be 4 years. You've got a client, his whole defense in the case is that the 2-year statute is running. That's it. Otherwise, he's exposed. There's 5,000 bills pending. You haven't paid any attention to this. A huge percentage of them don't get out of committee. If they get out of committee, they've still got a long way to go. You don't know anything about it. You're hoping for the best. And as the chief says, you're worrying about budget or something else. And your client's going to come back and say later on, well, but if we'd known about this when that bill was first introduced, we could have gone and hired a army of lobbyists, and we could have gotten the thing killed, and it would still be 2 years, and we'd win our case. And you should have told us. And your position is, well, maybe so. Depends on the facts.
I believe that this is a very fact-specific situation, in my opinion.
But in that situation, you say this is a unique case, but there's another case where somebody could obviously do something about a bill they didn't like if they'd only known about it, and you think the legislature should have told them.
That's our
position. Are they going to move for declaratory judgment? For the effective day. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We're talking here about a really important issue.
Yeah, let me ask you a question on that. The discussion has been about, well, does a lawyer legislator have to keep track of all the bills? But I'm going to focus your attention on, you're not a lawyer legislator. You are a lawyer who represents clients in real estate development, and there are any number of bills going through the legislature that will affect your client's business. This has nothing to do with lobbying. This has everything to do with the effective date of the bill. You are aware that if your client files a plat before the effective date of that bill, they're grandfathered in. If they fail to file that plat before the effective date, they're not grandfathered in, and it affects their business. You know that information. It's public information. It's an enrolled bill. The information is public. It's available to the public to know. Does the lawyer have a duty to notify the client about the effective date of that bill so that they can get grandfathered in, such that if they fail to do so, they have breached a duty to their client?
Judge Enoch, I think it's a matter of private tort law and private tort duty. A lawyer does have an obligation to pursue the interests of the client and disclose matters to the client.
It might be a fact issue as to whether or not the lawyer knew or should have known about this bill that would affect their client.
No, I disagree with that, because that requires you to go back into the legislative immunity that clothed Mr.
No, I'm talking about this isn't a lawyer. This isn't a lawyer legislator. This
He's
is just a
about
lawyer.
You.
I'm just
you,
talking about the lawyer.
I think there is room to sue a lawyer for the failure to read the advance sheet.
And that has nothing to do with whether or not the legislature voted for or voted against the bill. It just has to do with the lawyer's obligation to notify a client so the client can avoid the effect of whatever that result will be.
As I understand your question, Judge Enoch, that's correct. There is a cause of action that a client might be able to articulate that asserts that the lawyer failed adequately to research the scope of the client's business.
Now, let's assume that the lawyer is a legislator, but that's the only fact that's different. The client's complaint is that what you violated was that duty to notify me at a time that I could have protected my interest. And it's public information. There's no, you know, it's public. There's no difference about that. And there's no difference about the fact that had I gotten that information, I could have protected myself irrespective of what the vote was in the legislature. Why should the lawyer, just because a lawyer happens to be a legislator, be insulated from that kind of liability?
We have created the notion of immunity for legislators, Judge, not because we like legislators, not because we lack lawyers, but because we care about the way the system works. If you impose liability under that circumstance upon a lawyer or his law firm because he failed to pass along information that he acquired in the course of acting as a legislator, you are requiring that legislature devote his or her energy to protecting himself from answering to a civil action, rather than devoting its energy to the legislative process.
What if that lawyer is hired specifically to track the legislation and the lawyer is a legislator?
Yes, I agree there would be a problem. That lawyer, of course.
But would there be a private cause of action? I mean, it seems like what we're dealing with is each side is taking an absolute all or nothing position. We're trying to craft something that can allow some of these things to combine. And in certain situations, I could see where there'd be a clear conflict of interest, where a cause of action should lie, and there are others where I think there could not. And I don't know where all these. It seems each side is taking extreme positions on each side.
Judge O'Neill, under your hypothetical, if a lawyer is hired to monitor legislation, of course the lawyer has to exercise reasonable care in the course of monitoring that legislation. That hypothetical, though, we don't think applies to this case.
No, I understand that. Right. But you would say in that situation there would be a private cause of action despite the absolute immunity despite legislative immunity, because there is a duty to a client to disclose actual conflicts Should we limit it to actual conflicts or should we put it on the client if there's public notice of these bills that they have to track it? If you could craft a middle of the road rule, I'd like to hear it.
I can craft. I think it's easier than that, and that is that a legislature cannot be hired to monitor legislation for private clients. You just can't do it.
That's a start.
You can hire his partner.
I beg your pardon?
You can hire his partner.
And that throws us over to Rule 1.10. The law that we all grew up with, old DR 8101, said even the law firm couldn't do that. We had that old appearance of impropriety, and the ethics commissions all ruled that if there is one lawyer legislator, you cannot hire that firm to deal with the body the lawyer represents. We changed that in 1990 when we adopted 1.10. And the rule now says that the lawyer legislator can continue to act on matters involving general regulation, provided that he or she is screened. And it also says that the law firm, unlike what had been the law prior to 1990, the law firm can accept that representation, provided only that they screen that lawyer legislator. What the Court of Appeals has done in this case is they have ignored Rule 1.10 and focused on Rule 1.06, and they have imposed a duty on Harry Joe to get involved in the representation of private clients, and they have imposed a duty on Jenkins and Gilchrist, the law firm, not to screen Harry Joe from the representation of private clients. We simply cannot comply with the standard that the Court of Appeals has imposed upon a lawyer legislator, and at the same time comply with what Rule 1.10 tells us.
Well, the respondent argues that Mr. Joe was not screened appropriately.
I don't think that's what they argue, Judge Hecht. I think what they argue is that this was a matter under Rule 1.10. And that, and our problem with that is this wasn't even a matter. This was a matter. This involved general regulation within the city of Irving.
But if it had been, is there a fact question as to screening?
There is not a fact question as to screening because Harry Joe is not supposed to be involved in the process. I see that I'm out of time.
Mr. Money, it sounds like you disagree with Ms. War. I asked if a lawyer legislator was hired to represent a client on a specific matter, would there still be absolute immunity for that lawyer legislator in going before the city council on that matter they were hired to represent a private client on, even if they took a position in conflict with that private client's position or may have harmed that private client? Sounds like you're leaning more toward the position on that point of the brief from the amicus brief from Senators Ellis, Duncan, and others, and the Virginia ethics opinion.
Okay, well, the Virginia ethics opinion was decided under the old 8101 and the appearance of impropriety standard. I don't think I'm more on Ms. Ward's side on this. The problem with Ms. Ward's side on this issue, the problem I have is you just can't hire a legislator to look after your interests before that legislative body.
And if you do, what's the result?
If a lawyer is retained, if that individual legislator is retained to look after the client, among the things that that lawyer can be sued for, perhaps while he sits in jail, is he can be sued for not properly looking after the client, not fulfilling that job. By and large, Judge, lawyers are just like other people. All they want to do is help. And I'd urge this court not to impose upon lawyers a duty that they don't impose on any other legislator, and invite lawyers to do what they've done for over 200 years and participate in our government.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
That concludes today's argument. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.